That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G is specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. To find out more, call Paul Smith, the Managing Director, on 07887 501 441. That's 07887 501 441. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. Ben, I feel like we're in danger of starting this week's episode with a cliche that a week is a long time in politics. We're recording on a Monday, as we normally do, at about 11 a.m., 11:15 a.m. And I'm looking right now at a news item that says Humza Yousaf is to resign at midday. So we will see what happens in about 40 minutes. But a week is a long time in politics, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, the next hour is going to be a long time in politics. We keep doing this, Tom, don't we? Yeah. We seem to be recording at the moment when some news story is breaking or there's about to be some dramatic revelation of some kind in the news. So yes, it does seem like he is going to go. And I suppose we can only hope that the next First Minister, whoever it ends up being, will have some more common sense and might apply that to the wretched issue of the Hate Crime Act. But who knows? I mean, it's difficult to see how they could repeal it so quickly, I think.
It is difficult when law... No, it's taken so long, hasn't it? It took 3 years between being passed in Holyrood more than that. I think it got royal assent nearly 3 years ago and it's only just come in. So yeah. You're right. I think we would love to see that rolled back, but it doesn't feel like that is what would happen in practice. But it's a great opportunity for me to quote my favorite line from one of my favorite books. It's the Mordecai trilogy, which I think is now a film as well, by Kirill Bonfiglioli. And absolutely made me laugh in stitches when I read it a few years ago. But there's a line that has stayed with me forever, which is the plot's going very badly wrong for Mordecai. And it's a bit like poor Humza Yousaf. His political future is hanging like a thread so slender that were a spider to be offered it with which to spin a web, she would decline, citing safety concerns. And I have to say that particular line has stayed with me for probably more than 20 years. The book is something I often roll out when I'm, as it were, analyzing things that are going on like that. But yeah, we shall see whether that thread snaps.
Yes, which it seems like surely it will. And I'll have to add those books to my very, very expansive reading list, Tom, of things that I will get through in the next 30 to 40 years. Well, speaking of getting through lots and lots and lots of items, we do have a couple of sort of quick fire things in the news that we want to talk about very briefly before we get into the sort of substance of today's episode. So welcome everyone, and particularly as always to our new listeners. We want to start with the case of Rachel Mead, and this was reported in the Times on Sunday night. And Rachel is a social worker who we were in touch with a couple of years ago. And she's now been awarded nearly £60,000, £58,000 in damages from both Westminster City Council and Social Work England. And Tom, if I had to ask you to guess what issue Rachel has been in trouble for expressing a view about, what would you punt for?
Oh, goodness me. I'm a statistician. I'm a data person. I'll probably go to our data and say, well, what issue comes up 44% of the time, as we revealed last week? Is it by any chance the transgender issue?
You have it. Yes, it was one, indeed. Who would have guessed?
Who would have guessed? Who would have thought it? Yeah, this issue recurs and recurs, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's a great result for Rachel. It's been described as exemplary damages against the regulator. And I think my hope looking at this, because we deal so often at the Free Speech Union with regulators who are out of control, who are proposing completely bonkers EDI policies without any thought whatsoever to freedom of speech or the fact that some people might hold different views. I hope that this will be a real warning, a real shot across the bows for regulators who have been wading into critical race theory or transgender ideology, social justice, etc., without any regard to the fact that the people they're regulating have the right to a range of viewpoints on all of these issues. And I hope that this will be seen far beyond Social Work England and that others will take note of it, because it is a pretty startling success for Rachel. So fantastic news.
We have a long list, don't we, of cases like this where we would hope it is exactly that, a shot across the bows, and exactly that, that it leads to a change in the mood music, the behavior, the attitude, the policies. I think we continue to be surprised at how slowly these policies are being reversed, and in fact, often how relentlessly they continue to be embedded. It's fantastic news, but it is most certainly something that we are going to maybe be realistic about as to how much difference it makes.
The other story we want to speak about very quickly is a case that's been in the Telegraph. I expect that lots of people will have seen this story, in fact, over the last few weeks. And this is the case of Dr. Nathan Koffness, who is at the Faculty of Philosophy at Cambridge. And he had posted a blog about race, IQ, genetics, etc. And for that, his research affiliation, his link with Emmanuel College, has been terminated. So we are helping him with that case. We see it as a core academic freedom dispute that it's well within the territory in which Dr. Koffness is entitled to express his views.
The main thing we want to talk about today is really going back to a case that we discussed in some detail back, I think it was, Ben, in March, the case of Lindsay Smith, who was the Newcastle United fan who, with gender critical views, she ended up with a ban from Newcastle for, I think it was, 2 seasons. And we discovered that actually she had the Premier League put a dossier together on her, and it was almost like a stadium Stasi. Well, the update we want to bring today is that Lindsay Smith has started a crowdfunder, and with the help of the Free Speech Union, she's starting legal action against both Newcastle United Football Club, the club that banned her, and Premier League, who were the organization that essentially put this dossier together on her. And she's instructed 11 solicitors to write to both organizations under what's called the relevant pre-action protocol, setting out her claims against them, and including the following 2 strands to her complaint. The first is under the Data Protection Act 2018, whereby the claim is that there's been unlawful processing by both organizations of Lindsay's personal data, including special category personal data around her philosophical beliefs and sexual orientation. And the second is that under the Equality Act 2010, where the claim there is that there's been less favorable treatment of Lindsay by both organizations, so both Newcastle and the Premier League, because of her protected philosophical belief in the reality of sex. So there is a crowdfunder. We will put a link to the crowdfunder in the text, in the show notes. But what I found very interesting about this next stage, Ben, obviously Lindsay needs support for the crowdfunder, but also it's been reported on the BBC. And yes. Something we've talked about a lot is that we get traction in GB News, in talk radio, in talk TV. Sometimes we get traction on certain other platforms. But in essence, we struggle to get into the mainstream media. But on this one, at this stage, perhaps it's the CAS review effect. I don't know. The BBC have actually reported and even mentioned us, the Free Speech Union, in this case, in this next stage?
There does seem to be something, an increased willingness to note the Free Speech Union and our work in the last few months, for whatever reason. I think you're right. I think there's certainly a post-Cass review effect. And also, the evidence is just so abundantly clear that, in fact, cancel culture is not something that has been invented. It's not a sort of bogeyman dreamt up by the right-wing press, that this is something that's happening to all sorts of different people, as we've just described in Lindsay's case, and that it in fact, it can't just continually be ignored, because it's so clear that this is what's going on. There's so much polling, for instance, about people feeling the need to self-censor and so on. So all of this stuff is real, and it feels to me like the BBC has been bludgeoned by the abundance of evidence into finally reporting some of these things. So that's obviously a very welcome development. And Lindsay's case certainly deserves as much attention as it can possibly get. I mean, some of the detail, particularly, for instance, on the data protection side of things, is just extraordinary. So they were building up this dossier, and it went so far beyond the quote-unquote offending social media posts. It included things like where she walked her dog. It was just the most brazen, blatant and chilling infringement of her rights, and an act of discrimination against her because of her beliefs, which are of course the beliefs of a majority of us. So really just an extraordinary case, and it's good to see the BBC picking it up.
Yeah, and we will see hopefully more of this, because we do these cases, obviously, but more of the mainstream media picking up on these important cases. I recently got the book that Lionel Shriver's just written, and it just was delivered to me this week. It's called Manias, or Mania, and it's all about what happens at each stage of a mania. And, you know, I would think most of our listeners would agree that the gender ideology is and has been a mania. And one of the things that strikes me, I haven't started the book, to be brutally honest, but I have heard Lionel Shriver speak about it on various podcasts, actually, recently, and across the press. And I think she's also written about it in various publications. But the end of a mania tends to be a bit of a damp squib. There's no reckoning. There's no big reckoning. It tends to be that those who realize they were on, in inverted commas, the wrong side of history, now a very abused term, tend just to go quiet. Their tail goes between their legs, and they almost do this other thing of saying, well, we never quite said that. We weren't denying that women should be allowed to have their own spaces, and we weren't denying that you should be allowed to have views of the gender critical views, and that there was another side to the debate. And yet you go back and you look at the old items that we've discussed about for years, and we discover, well, actually, they kind of were trying to shut down this debate. So it's great to see after the CAS report, the change in the temperature. However, it's frustrating that there doesn't ever seem to be a great day of reckoning. It's just a quiet admission.
Yes, at most. I'm really excited to read. I need to order myself a copy of Mania. The plot, roughly, for people who've not picked up a copy yet or not heard of it, is that there is a mental parity movement which has arisen in it's set basically in the present day, isn't it, or in the near future, I think, and it's a sort of extended metaphor for trans ideology. And in this world, any discrimination based on differences between intelligence is, I think, criminalized or whatever, or taboo. So I need to read it. It sounds very interesting. And that brings us back, actually, of course, to what the substance of the case at Cambridge is all about, which, of course, when you're dealing with questions of race and IQ, is even more charged. But so much of the scientific understanding of IQ and heritability, even without getting into questions of race, so much of that is already prescribed, I think, and is something that many people find very, very, well, almost to be a sort of forbidden topic, to be completely verboten. Yeah, I need to read it, Tom. Anyway, I think we could do a book review, couldn't we? If we have a few weeks to get ourselves together and read it, we could do an episode on this. It sounds very interesting.
We should do that. It's a very clever premise, as you say, that IQ and the essence of the meritocracy suddenly becomes not allowed in a society. In a way, we can say, oh, it's a bit of a dystopian fictional idea, but I when you say it's fictional, I beg to differ in many ways. I think, well, it might just be a playback of much of reality as it's turned out over the last 10 years and accelerated over the last 5. But I think we should come back to that most certainly. But you wanted to talk about a tweet you saw over the weekend. Am I right, Ben?
Yes, this was something that was doing the rounds. And it was a comment from Billy Bragg in The Guardian. And I'll read it to listeners now. He said, "My problem with people like Rowling, like Julie Bindle, is really who they are lined up with. That's what I see with Rowling and the others. They are on the wrong side of the table." And I just thought this encapsulated, and I'm sure lots of people who saw this thought exactly the same thing, this kind of bizarre, to me, tribal way of thinking about these issues. Because if you're just taking the view of such and such agrees with this person who I don't like, therefore whatever they say must, by that very fact of their connection, be wrong. I mean, firstly, it's obviously plainly idiotic. But secondly, it just seems to be one of those ways of thinking where if you think like that, it's impossible, very difficult to understand that other people don't think like that. And the reverse is true as well. If you go through life, insofar as any of us can do, evaluating arguments on their own merits rather than on the basis of, you know, using a kind of heuristic shortcut of, oh, I don't like that person, so they must be wrong, it's very difficult to get yourself in the mindset of that level of tribalism. And the idea that you would discount somebody and what they were saying just because of who they're sat with or who else happens to agree with them about this one particular issue. And I just thought that was worth reflecting on.
Can I challenge you on that then? Because
yes,
I wasn't persuaded by that argument, actually. It's the old adage that your enemy's enemy is not your friend. And I think the key word here is tribalism and how tribalism plays out. So first of all, I think we're all tribal. I think the very essence of society, human society, is tribal. When we talk about the family unit, that's our tribe, that's our group. We have a loyalty to that group that goes beyond necessarily whether we agree with them or we don't agree with them. We will sit on their side of the table in all sorts of situations where we may not agree with them. We are hardwired to be tribal. I mean, see Romeo and Juliet. And I mean, I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it always leads to great outcomes, but it's a reality. Then going back to my point about your enemy's enemy is not always your friend. As we particularly get over this gender critical issue, I have a feeling that we're going to find fractions and fissions within the coalitions, as it were, that have come together, that actually come back to the point that's being made here. You know, people have sat on the same side of the table who under the surface have very, very significant disagreements. Hamza Yousaf is a great example here in the way that the SNP and the Greens came together for the purposes of creating a government. And then it's broken up very quickly as soon as a very particular issue, in this case, the gender critical issue, and actually the green issue, of course, which was another trigger, and net zero, as that's become one on which they take a different view. So I think I get your point. You shouldn't argue simply by virtue of which side of the table someone is on. But if it's taken as a package of views and a philosophy and an outlook on life, it's not an unfair observation to make.
But I think people ought to reflect on the fact that, as you say, our nature is to be tribal, but we no longer live in tribes. We live in a modern, advanced, liberal, democratic society. And we
do live in tribes.
Well, yes. I mean, we do, to the extent that family and friends and so on are sort of like a tribe. But in terms of thinking through political issues, how to govern a country, what you think about something, you can, to an extent, use the heuristic of this is somebody I admire, who I generally respect and agree with. So if they say this, I probably do agree with that. That's how most people, I think, probably think about politics. If you're a conservative, well, if there are any conservatives left, you will take the line of Mrs. Thatcher instinctively, because you don't have time necessary to think through all of the arguments about every issue of the day for yourself. None of us do. But what I think this is saying is that there is a kind of taint that is attached to people on the right, and therefore any person on the left who happens to agree with them is wrong, because they are within this sort of miasma. They are also tainted by association. And that I just thought that's such an inadequate way of thinking. It's such an inadequate way of thinking. And it might be that all of us, as I say, because we don't have time to think through everything for ourselves, and we do have to rely to some extent on people we trust and know, or people we admire in public life or whatever. But to say that in writing, or to say that in an interview, that your views have arisen or are sustained because you don't like the people that such and such a person, J.K. Rowling in this case, happens to agree with, that's just such a shoddy piece of thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, I think the issue is, though, again, Ben, is the level at which the conversation is taking place. And, you know, Twitter is such a, although this was in The Guardian, I think, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yeah,
it was an
article.
Yeah. You know, but taking the more general point about the way conversations take place, they take place in memes. They take place in 30 word, as used to be. I think Twitter, you can now say more than that, but it used to be trying to fit things into just 30 words. And the ability to provide nuance to the discussion was almost eliminated in the Twitter sphere for a long time because of it. And I think it's one of the reasons that the podcast and the long form conversation is so very, very popular, because it provides an alternative where you can hear the nuance and you can explore complicated issues at length and really play out the arguments. So, yeah, but I do come back to, I like your point about not everyone has time, bandwidth, energy to think through all sides of every issue. And when you were speaking, it reminded me of Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. You know, we have two systems of how to think. One is the instinctive, got to get out of here now. There's a wolf coming down the road. Move. That's the thinking fast. And then there's the thinking slow, thinking rationally, thinking through a situation more systematically. And I think that we're set up to have that sort of wolf response, that flight response in so many of the arguments, and to pick a side very quickly. We've got followers at risk. We've got our profile at risk. We've got the way people think of us at risk. So perhaps I'm a little bit more understanding than you, Ben. You're very puritanical on this, but I kind of get where people are coming from.
Well, I think what's interesting about what you've just said then is that, so if you're Billy Bragg, or you're somebody who is completely on board with transgender ideology, perhaps that's the way in which to help me understand it, because you're not saying you're not using that slow method of methodical consideration, or using the instinctive. There's a bear. There's a danger. This great big Tory transphobe. And so you're having that a more instinctive response to it. And I think that must be right. It just seems to me such an embarrassing admission to say that you know, that you kind of view the world in a sort of goodies and baddies way. And one of the things I like about our work is that it's genuinely cross-partisan, and we have really remarkable coalitions of people. I mean, just look at Scotland and the coalition of people who are all on the same side on freedom of speech. But if conversation turned to any other topic, would be in, should we say, vociferous disagreement.
Hopefully we'd be in vociferous disagreement, but then still going to the bar afterwards. Yes, exactly. For a drink together. I always take that as the key. Yes. Thermometer. There was a fantastic clip that was going around YouTube about a month ago, it may have been longer ago, of a classroom where there was a teacher teaching the children critical thinking. I think one of the children had said, you know, we know that, J.K., this is what the child was saying, we know J.K. Rowling's a transphobe, dot, dot. And he stopped and said, okay, let's just take that statement. Let's break that statement down. So why do you say that? And the child said, well, you know, it's generally understood. Okay, well, let's get specific. Are you talking about what you think? Or are you talking about what your friends have said to you? Well, my friends, okay, so let's narrow it down to what you think. And then he breaks it down further for the child and says, let's have a look at what J.K. Rowling's actually said. And they go and pick out a few tweets. And so in what way is that trans? And it's a wonderful 10-minute, 12-minute clip of a teacher teaching critical thinking. And at the end, the pupil says, I feel a bit silly now, because I was just saying what my friends have said. I was repeating, parroting back what my friends have said. Now we've done some critical thinking, and I can see that J.K. Rowling is not a transphobe, and that this label is just being thrown around as an insult without the context and the thinking behind it. And it is something that struck me there, because, you know, we talk about long-form discussion, but also that critical thinking. And our young people, particularly with everything we're seeing on the streets of London and all the things we're seeing in Columbia University, the question is, you know, are our young people being equipped to argue that through, and if necessary, to stand outside the pack, outside the tribe, and say, I'm going to stand alone on this because my critical thinking says we come to a different conclusion. I saw some students in Columbia being interviewed, Ben, and obviously, you know, it's just one or two people who turned up at that protest. This is the protest that's going on the encampments in Columbia University. Yeah. And the interviewer said, you know, why are you here? And they said, oh, I don't know. We were told that we have to be here and that everyone should get down here and join the protest. And it just absolutely blew my mind away, because I thought, at what point in historical student protests could you have gone down to the protest, spoken to the students, and the students turn around to you and say, oh yeah, we don't really know why we're here. That is a new thing, and a very worrying thing, and a total absence, it would seem, of critical thinking and willingness to think it through for oneself, not have one's thinking done by others.
Yeah, and so those people are relying on the heuristic of, this is what my friends are saying, this is what people like me ought to think, this is what I'm seeing on TikTok, basically. And if that's the only stuff you are seeing. That's an interesting point, actually, Tom. I mean, I wonder if, you know, if you looked at Vietnam protests, anti-war protests in the 60s and 70s, I might go and do this, actually, and just try and find some interviews on YouTube with protesters, asking them why they're there and what the issues are. And I would anticipate that you'd get a much higher level of response, because at that time, I suppose it's just much more difficult to get swept away in a sort of social contagion, because you do have to read the newspapers for yourself or discuss these things verbally with other people. You're not being subjected to bombardment by a social media algorithm, which is, you know, giving you 3, 4, 5 second clips all day, every day while you're glued to a smartphone. So it's a completely different way of getting from the, you know, why do you leave your house and turn up to a protest? It's a completely different process for getting there. I'm going to do that, and I will report back next week. Yeah.
Well, they're all, I think there have always been useful idiots. I imagine time there have always been useful idiots. But that would be really interesting to see the tenor and the quality of the conversation. Certainly, I do my own little experiments of comparing, and this will surprise no one, you know, comparing Question Time or a late night chat show from the 70s or the 80s, where you used to get fantastic guests like Sir Laurence Olivier turning up for a late night chat with one of the great big beasts, one of the great big media beasts at the time. And they were just such high quality. We spoke in very beginning when we started podcasting, Ben, we spoke about Civilization, the documentary, Civilization, Kenneth Clark's great magnum opus. I get my Latin endings incorrect. And my Latin teacher would hit me at that point.
Back to school with you, son.
I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. Is it nominative? Is it accusative? But anyway, you know, that great vast documentary series and the quality of it. So yeah, we got lots of, but I suppose also history is written by the winners, isn't it? So these are the things that have lasted. And I'm sure at the time on the televisions, on our television sets, there was plenty of stuff that wasn't that good that we just don't see anymore and that's been lost forever. We hear and we retain the cultural high points.
Yes, I think there must be an element of that kind of selection bias. But I do think I agree. I mean, we're fortunate, obviously, we can live in an age where if you are so inclined, you can go and see an interview that Peter Ustinov or whoever's given on a chat show in the 80s. And you see clips of these things circulating on social media. And it does feel like there has been, I'm afraid to say, a rather marked decline in the quality and calibre of actors particularly. In terms of their ability to speak publicly, articulately about current events. And I'm trying to phrase that quite politely. But
You're doing very well, Ben. But we all know what you're saying.
Yes.
But we should move on to our next item, shouldn't we? Which I thought it's worth revisiting this case. We've been following it and mentioned it in a few podcast episodes, and we also mentioned it, you may remember this, Ben, we mentioned it in our Christmas get together as with staff, and I think that's also on YouTube, where we had our heroes and our zeros of 2023. And one of our heroes was Päivi Räsänen from Finland, who is this ex-MP in Finland. She's a politician, she's a Christian, and she's gone through the ringer, having had to go through a court process twice in which the prosecutor in Finland, the general prosecutor, has pursued her. Really, there are three original things that she, in inverted commas, did. First of all, she posted a photo of Romans chapter 1, verses 24 to 27 from the New Testament that describes same-sex relationships as shameful. Secondly, a short soundbite was pulled from a live one-hour radio debate given in 2019. And thirdly, a pamphlet that she wrote for her church in 2004 entitled Male and Female, He Created Them. So very much about homosexuality and her views on that. And the prosecutor took umbrage at that and said it was hateful. She's gone through a court process twice. And amazingly, incredibly, although one of those three accusations has now been dropped, and she's been found innocent, the prosecutor's pursuing her to the Supreme Court in Finland. So the other two accusations are back alive again and are going to be pursued through court. Again, this is a 4-5 year process now. And, you know, I think, I don't know what you think about this, Ben, but it just seems straight. It's like the Terminator. This prosecutor just will not give up, will not stop. It's the last scene of the original Terminator film.
It is completely bonkers. The fact of the decision to prosecute in the first place is bonkers, but the fact that having gone through two prosecutions, that the prosecution can now appeal against the decision and drag it back to court for a third time, it is just really extraordinary. And I think particularly given Finland's current and historical, you know, the geopolitics of where Finland is and its border with Russia and so on, it's somewhat undermined, to put it mildly, European claims of standing for enlightenment values and freedom of speech and tolerance of religion and so on. If somebody can be prosecuted three times for quoting from the Bible, just seems an utterly extraordinary situation. And the fact, as you said, that it's been going on for the best part of 5 years now.
Well, I'll quote Paul Coleman, who is the ADF International's executive director. ADF is Alliance Defending Freedom. And Paul Coleman, reflecting on this, said, "This is a watershed case in the story of Europe's creeping censorship. The state's insistence on continuing this prosecution after almost five long years, despite such clear and unanimous rulings from the lower courts, is alarming." And then this is the point that I really thought really struck me. "The process is the punishment in such instances," which we know, "resulting in a chill on free speech for all citizens observing." And that's the point. It's been going on for 5 years. The citizens are watching this. The Finnish people and further abroad in Europe and beyond are watching this and seeing what's happening. 5 years and it's still not over. For holding Christian beliefs, for verbalizing, putting into words Christian beliefs. And the citizens are observing and say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." Are we allowed to say that? That sounds quite Christian. "There, but for the grace of God, go I. I better shut up." So they're not saying this stuff, you know. And this is what is, that's what we mean by the chilling of free speech. It's just no longer said. People just go quiet. They just don't say what they believe anymore.
And this, it takes us all the way back to where we started with the situation in Scotland, of course, doesn't it? Because you can count the effects of the Hate Crime Act. You can measure it in terms of records of non-crime hate incidents, of arrests and prosecutions once we get to that unhappy stage. But what you can't measure is the number of people who just simply feel unable to speak their minds, that it's just not worth the hassle anymore, or that if they do something, they might, you know, say something, they might end up with the police knocking on their door. All of those effects cannot be measured. And as we've said of cancel culture more broadly, the toll of it really can't ever be calculated, because we don't know how many books haven't been written or published, or television programs that haven't been broadcast or commissioned or whatever. And all of these things we can't measure. And we spoke last week, I think it was, Tom, didn't we, about our data and the things we can measure, and the 2,500 cases that the Free Speech Union has been involved with in just over 4 years. But there is a lot that we will never be able to count in terms of the harm that it's done. So I suppose on that note, I'd say thank you all for your support, if you're members of the Free Speech Union, and thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you to all our listeners. And we'll obviously, I think that's probably the end of today, but we will see whether or not we still have a Scottish government, or whether an election's been called, or whatever this time next week. So we're very excited about what happens over the next few days. But thank you to everyone for listening, and we wish you a good week. Goodbye.